machine, and what looks like a ghost is actually a hemorrhage. Ghost in the machine.
Just going to record you, is that okay?
Okay, yeah. So we'll go to the next next slide. So when someone stands up and they want to tell you that they know more than you and they're going to discuss things about what they're doing, you need to actually sort of know that they really do know what they're talking about. So I thought I would talk a little bit about who I am, which is why I sort of cut Steve a bit short. So if I'm talking about science, do I know anything about science? Well, it turns out that I am actually a scientist. I studied medicine at Sydney University. And then I came up here and I studied medical imaging, which is a subspecialty of medicine. And I currently run the MRI unit, which is the magnetic resonance imaging unit at John Hunter, but also at the Calvary Mater, and there's a new MRI that just started up at the New Maitland Hospital, which I'm also in charge of. I do mostly neuroradiology, which is imaging of the brain and the spine. So any disorders of the brain and the spine, I tend to be involved with. I also do quite a lot of research. So over the years, I've studied diseases of the brain, and I've got about 60 papers. They always say 60 papers in peer-reviewed journals, and what does that really mean? It means that you've actually got to write something that's of such importance that you have to actually, people that are also in the area think it's worthwhile and they'll actually put it into some sort of publication rather than being completely rubbish. So I actually am a scientist, so I do know a reasonable amount about brain stuff. But I'm also a Christian. I've believed since I was a teenager. I've read the Bible from cover to cover several times, and I tend to believe what it says. And so I think that puts me in a unique spot to be able to talk about this sort of idea. So if we go to the next slide. So what ends up happening as you're growing up, and I'm looking around the room, most of us, well, some of us aren't, but most of us are 20-somethings. When you're a kid, you're really only interested in sleeping, eating, and playing. And then all of a sudden, you get into your late teens, early 20s, and you suddenly look around and you think, well, what's it all about? Why am I here? Does God really exist? Or am I just, you know, a figment of someone's imagination? You come up with all of these sort of existential sort of why am I here thoughts. And so part of that is trying to work out what is going on. And there's lots of different ways of looking at it from the world's point of view. And Colin and wife have just turned up. We've only just started, so you haven't missed anything. I didn't really gave who I am, and you know that already, because Colin is a radiologist, just like me, and in fact, Colin was one of my mentors when I was going through training, so we know each other pretty well. So where do you come from? What are you doing here, and what's actually happening? We'll go to the next slide. So it comes down to the idea that there are really two ways of looking at the world. So there's faith in God, and then there's science. They're the main sort of ways of looking at it. And it's usually portrayed to people that science is at one end of the spectrum. It's all about knowledge and no faith. And God is all the way at the other end of the spectrum. It's all about faith and no knowledge. And that no good scientists would actually ever believe in God. But in fact, that's not true. There's a spectrum. So that's why I put the point up. So at one end, you've got theists. So they believe in God. And at the other end, you've got the radical atheists, which we'll get to in a minute. And sort of towards the middle, there's agnostics. Now, agnostics don't really know whether God exists or not. They sort of just don't know. And they don't really care what you know, which is fine. So they're just sort of like... The atheists don't believe that there's a God. Rather than not knowing whether there's a God, they actually actively don't believe that there's a God, but they don't really care what you believe either. And then the radical atheists, they actually don't believe there's God, but they actually hate the idea of God, and they actually hate the idea that you believe in God. And they're sort of more towards the evangelical sort of end of the spectrum. They want you to change your mind if you do believe in God. So to give you an idea that scientists of all types, and I've picked leaders of the different groups. So in the theists, I've put down here Isaac Newton. Now, Isaac Newton, for those of you who don't know, was the one that actually discovered all the laws of motion. So he really kicked off physics. If you didn't like physics at high school, then you can blame Isaac. The other thing that he was big in is he was the one that first discovered calculus. So if you can remember in maths doing integrations and all that sort of stuff and you hated it, then you can blame him for that too. But it turns out that not only was he a great scientist, but he actually spent more time, more effort, and more of his writings were on theology. Right, and that's been proven time and time again. He actually spent more time writing about theology than he did about math, about science. So in the agnostic sort of atheist sort of group, this is, if you don't know, Francis Crick. Now, he got a Nobel Prize as one of the people that discovered the structure of DNA, so how your genome actually works, where all the information in your cell is. He got that. And he realised early on that this DNA, you know, it's actually quite... there's a lot of information in it, and he didn't really believe the underlying theory that it all just sort of like popped into existence. It didn't really work for him. He didn't really believe in evolution. We'll get into what that means. And so he came up with this idea of directed panspermia, which is the first cells were actually seeded on Earth by intelligent beings from another planet, so like in the space aliens, which you might think is a bit nutty, but... But anyway, he's sort of like more agnostic atheist. He doesn't necessarily believe in God, but he doesn't really care what you believe in. And now the archetypal radical atheist is this guy, Richard Dawkins, who you may or may not know about. So he is a professor in the biological sciences in England. And he's written a number of books, some of which I've read, Climbing Mount Improbable and The Blind Watchmaker. It's all about this idea about evolution and whether or not we could actually come from... into existence without God. And obviously, being a radical atheist, he hates the idea of God. And his last book, which I didn't read because I knew what it was going to be about, The God Delusion. So that's his idea that even if you do believe in God, you should read my book and then you should throw that away because it's completely and utterly worthless and not worth thinking about. So scientists come in all different breeds. So go to the next one. So I've sort of mentioned evolution a couple of times. So the main idea in science, obviously, science doesn't like the idea of God because science is all about what you can test and what you can actually, what you can actually handle and look at. We'll get to that in a minute. So the idea of evolution is that you start sort of like with one organism. So the evolutionary theory is basically that all of the organisms that have ever grown or developed from past organisms, and essentially, you might have started with a single-celled organism, and then over time, there are random changes. So the genome is the way the information gets stored in the cell. Random changes to the way that happens, some of which are good and some of which are bad. And then there's a selection process based on the good ones being kept because they're more likely to reproduce and the bad ones being got rid of because they're less likely to reproduce. And from the point of view of just standing back and looking at from 10,000 feet, it sort of makes sense. I mean, you know, maybe you could do that. I mean, like all of these things, though, the devil is in the actual details. And so this is roughly what the evolution of man sort of should have looked like. You know, you start with a chimpanzee, and if you go back further, you eventually get back to, like, single-celled organisms, and then, maybe we're devolving. And, of course, I'm not against women or anything, but this just came up, evolution of women. So, I mean, maybe some things don't change. We'll go to the next slide. So the idea that you actually evolved, if you go back far enough to single-celled organisms, well, what do single-celled organisms look like? Well, they basically pond scum. It's basically just... a pool of water with a whole lot of... So great moments in evolution. So this is Gloria here, and she's catching up with her long-lost relatives. There you go. Next slide. So essentially, that it comes down to this idea that there are essentially two worldviews, and they don't really overlap very well. So there's the worldview of God. Now, God tells you in his book, which you should read at some stage, that you're actually made in his image. You have worth, and he loves you very much, right? So the radical atheists have their own Bible, and so Richard Dawkins, in his book, he was that radical atheist, A River Out of Eden. Now, they tend to use a lot of biblical references because they want to sort of rub your nose in it, so Eden and a river. Obviously, there is a river coming out of Eden in the Bible as well. He says, the universe that we observe has precisely the properties that we should expect. If there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. So obviously, if you think about that, that means that your whole existence is worthless. The universe doesn't care whether you exist or not. You're just a fluke. And so obviously that leads to unhappiness. So they're the two options. We'll go to the next slide. So is there any evidence for evolution? Now, the evidence that's been spouted for evolution is wide and varied. Now, the poster child, the first evidence that was put forward for evolution is this idea of peppered moths. Now, I'll tell you what that's about. So essentially, in England, before the Industrial Revolution, okay, most of the trees were light, and they had light lichen on them. And there were these peppered moths that were all light. Now, obviously, if you're a moth, you don't want to be eaten by a bird, so you want to sort of blend in quite well. So obviously, there are actually white peppered moths here, but you can't see them. And there's one dark one, which the birds could see. So what ended up happening when the Industrial Revolution came along was all of a sudden the whole lot of soot was put out because it was essentially all coal-fired and all the trees went black. And so all the peppered moths were suddenly very easy to pick, and the birds came along and knocked them all off, or started knocking them all off. And what ended up happening was the peppered moths actually started going darker. So they all started going dark. And that made them blend in better. The ones that were obviously better at blending in didn't get picked off as much, so they actually reproduced more. And so the idea that there was a change, there was a variation. The variation was thought to be brought about by some sort of new material. Back then they didn't know much about genetics, but they thought there must be some sort of new material that has changed the colour of these moths, and it's been retained, and so that was evolution in action. Now, if you go to the future and go back, and now we can actually look at the genetic code of moths, you can actually work out exactly what happened. And it turned out that the ability to change colour was already in the genes of the moth, right? And all that actually happened was the genes got rearranged. I won't go into what all the jargon's about. But essentially, the idea that the genes for the dark moths were already there, all that happened was they just got switched on. Now, unfortunately for evolution sort of works best if you actually get new information, right? It doesn't really work if the information's already there and it just gets switched on, because one of the other things about evolution is that it's not meant to have any sort of forethought. There's no planning. It's just completely blind. So the idea that there was a gene in there that would make the moths dark, even though they didn't need it to be dark until the Industrial Evolution came along, sort of hints to a god, and they don't like that. Go to the next one. So, and the other thing that people often point out is that, humans have sort of done a form of evolution with dogs. Okay, so the original dog was a grey wolf. Now, I don't know if you've noticed, but these dogs are all a lot different to this grey wolf. So the original grey wolf had big teeth, long grey hair, and was quite vicious. All of these things would be much more likely to lick you to death than take your face off. And you'll notice that they're not grey. I mean, some of them are grey. I mean, he's grey. But there's all sorts of colours. They've got stripes. Some of them have got spots. So surely all of these different variations must be new information. The problem is, of course, that all of this has occurred over a few thousand years of breeding. And it turns out that all of these variations come about from genes that are already in the wolf, even though the wolf doesn't need to have spots, doesn't need to have short hair, doesn't need to have a short muzzle, doesn't need any of this stuff, so that doesn't really work either. Now, there's lots of words at the bottom. Don't worry, I'll read them out. They're just there to remind me what to say. So one of the big changes between your domestic dog and a grey wolf, you'll obviously note, is if you bend down and want to pat a grey wolf, it's just as likely to take your face off, right? Now, if you actually bend down and pet someone's nice, I don't know, whatever, beagle or something, it's more likely to lick your face. So it turns out in humans there's this genetic disorder called Williams syndrome. And it's a really interesting disorder. It's an abnormality that's basically an error in the genes. And so what ends up happening is that people that have Williams syndrome are hypersocial, extremely empathetic, which means that they like people, very friendly towards strangers, and especially as friendly as children. So the interesting thing was when they started looking at the difference in the genome, so the underlying information in a wolf as opposed to the modern domestic dog, Guess what? Domestic dogs actually have a variation in their genome, so they have actually genes switched off that would give humans Williams syndrome. So your cuddly pet dog actually has a form of Williams syndrome. And it makes sense when you think about it, because they're very social, they're very empathetic, they're very, very friendly to strangers, and they don't bite your face off. So, and that really doesn't work out. And that, just to show you that this doesn't come from a garbage journal, this is actually a scientific journal. So they're actually saying, isn't this interesting? A genetic disorder in humans that makes them more like puppy dogs is exactly what makes puppy dogs like puppy dogs. There you go. So go to the next one. So, I don't know if you know much classical art, but this is a sculpture by a man called Rodin, and it's called The Thinker. You can obviously see he's sitting there thinking. And when Rodin, who made this sculpture, which I have actually seen, it's in a park in France, when I saw this, he was asked, well, how do you actually make these fantastic sculptures? And he said, well, basically I choose a block of marble and I just chop off whatever I don't need. And so essentially what looks like is happening a lot of the time is that evolution is starting off with a grey wolf that has a whole lot of genes it doesn't need, and when humans are basically evolving it, they're chopping off all the bits that you don't need because you really want to have a puppy dog. So go to the next one. So that's not really sort of the way it works. And just to show you that this isn't really just me, you know, gilding the lily and showing you stuff that, you know, is sort of like pro what I'm trying to explain. So there are two journals here which are actually quite quite prestigious. One's Nature Ecology and the other one was one called Evolution. And they both came up with the same idea from different research groups. And what they basically looked at is they looked at the genome, so all of the different instructions of vast numbers of different animals and plants and things all through the animal kingdom, essentially. One group was in Spain and one was in the United Kingdom. And what they actually came up with, they sort of said, well, you know, it's just, and a lot of this stuff has, to be able to get into a decent journal, you actually have to couch it in a way that will impress evolutionists. If you try and say that this is actually more towards God, then that'll just get kicked out because they're not going to accept it. So they've hammered home just how inessential genes can be and how creatively evolution can be in losing them. By analysing hundreds of genomes across the animal kingdom, researchers in Spain and the United Kingdom show that a startling degree of gene loss pervades the tree of life. Well, that doesn't make sense. I mean, so here's a fellow who's thinking to himself, can I make a fortune by gambling all my money away? Well, there's a very, 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 very small chance you could do that. You could put all your money through the slot machines and you might get the jackpot. But the vast majority of people who think that way end up destitute. So, and that's the difficulty with this sort of thing, is that if you're giving away all of your genes in the idea that you're then becoming, that's how you're going to get your evolution to work, then, you know, you might end up in that. Completely bankrupt. We'll go to the next one. So, most people that want to try and refute evolution, and I don't necessarily have, I mean, I'm not a rabid anti-evolutionist. I mean, I do believe that there is the possibility of some occurring, but only in, say, viruses and bacteria, because obviously, if it's all about reproduction, you want to have somebody that's reproducing billions of times in a short time frame. So if you look at something like, obviously, COVID has changed. It started off with the Alpha variant, and then there was a Delta variant, and there's an Omicron variant. But if you look at how quickly viruses reproduce, there have been billions and billions of viral particles. So obviously, there's many, many more chances for something new and wonderful to come out of that. But anyway, the problem ends up being is that if you go much higher than viruses, it ends up being very, 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 very difficult. So as I said, it's always the detail that is the problem. The devil's always in the detail. So somewhere along the line, if you want to believe in evolution, the first single-celled organism, that's pond scum, had to have come from somewhere. Obviously, Crick didn't believe it could come out of thin air, and so he was sort of getting the, you know, space aliens to sort of seed it here. So To give you a little bit of biological knowledge, the way that it works is that proteins, and you know about proteins because all the guys want to eat lots of protein to get muscle, and they all have in their protein powder. So what are proteins? Well, proteins, it turns out, are strings of things called amino acids, and there are only 20 that the body, and in fact, the entire animal kingdom use. And there they are. I mean, you don't have to look at them, but there's 20 of them. And they all have different ways that they interact with each other. Some are water-loving, some are water-hating, some will actually join with other ones. But the way it works is that you string them all together like little pearls on a necklace. And when you string them all together, what ends up happening is that they will either attract or reject each other, or they will interact with each other. And then that string will actually make a three-dimensional shape. That is what hemoglobin looks like in its three-dimensional shape. And so, well, that's all very confusing. Why would that be important? It's actually the shape, the specific shape that gives a protein its use. So hemoglobin's use is to hold oxygen. If you didn't have hemoglobin, your blood would not carry anywhere near enough oxygen to keep you alive. Which, I mean, you can actually get rid of carbon dioxide without any way of carrying it, but oxygen you need hemoglobin for. And so it turns out that this specific shape is designed so that it will actually, with an iron atom in the middle of it, will actually carry four oxygen atoms. And if you change too much of this by changing some of the amino acids, it won't work, all right, because the shape will change. And if the shape changes, then the ability to hold the oxygen won't work. So if you think about it, the first single-celled animal, and we know that there are very, very, very simple single-celled animals, and so they would have to have been similar, is composed of thousands of different proteins. Now, if you've got 20 amino acids to pick from, so this is part of the idea is, this is a bit like finding a needle in a haystack. So if you want to know whether it's worthwhile searching for a needle in a haystack, you need to actually know how many needles are there in my haystack and how big is my haystack. So the idea about if you're trying to find the one and only one protein that's going to work, well, there's only one of those, okay? So there's not many needles for a start. How big is the haystack? Well, it turns out the 20 amino acids, now most proteins are made up of at least 100 amino acids, sometimes longer than that. But if you're going to actually randomly generate all the proteins you can make, there's 20 to the power of 100 combinations. Now, most big numbers go completely over everyone's head and you've got no idea what that means. You think, yeah, it's a big number, but, you know, whatever, who cares? So it turns out that there are 10 to the power of 91 atoms in the known universe. Now, the difference between this number and that number is at least, in fact, it's greater. It's 10 to the power of 7, which is, 10 to the power of 6 is a million, so that's sort of like 10 million. So, in fact, if every single atom, and obviously this doesn't work because you need lots of atoms to make proteins, but if every single atom in the known universe was a protein and you were looking for a specific one, then, and even if they were changing every 10 or 20 seconds, I mean, you know, the amount of time available since the Big Bang, which is billions of years, is actually not enough to be sure that you would find the single protein that you're looking for. So the haystack is enormous, right? Now, if you then wanted to say, well, okay, now the simplest single-cell organism has 1,000 or a couple of thousand of those, and all of them all have to come together and all be encapsulated in a membrane, what's the chance of that happening? Well, it's effectively zero. And that's generally how people try and refute evolution, but it doesn't work. Get to the next slide. The evolutionists fight back. The multiverse, infinity as God. Now, I didn't have music clips, but if you can sort of think about, you know, if you can think about the Sting in the background. So how do they get around this? Well, most people that think about this know that that is a big problem. And so what they actually do is they invoke their own God, which is called infinity. So obviously, if some chance of something happening is infinitely small, so the chance of the first cell being created is infinitely small, then you need to have an infinite number of attempts. So if you multiply infinitely small by infinitely big, it definitely must have happened. So how do they do this? Well, we know. I said to you that, you know, our one universe isn't enough to know that you're going to get one protein. So what they do is they have an infinite number of universes. They call it the multiverse. And so what the theory is that, in fact, there are out there infinite numbers of universes, right? And so obviously we just happily live in a universe where the first single cell organism popped into existence. And because of that, we shouldn't be so surprised that it happened, right? And it sort of makes sense. You think, well, okay, yeah, okay. It's infinitely unlikely to happen, but it's not zero. And if there's an infinite number of attempts, then if you multiply any number that isn't zero by infinity, you're definitely going to get a number. In fact, what they actually say is because this number is infinity, that means that there must be an infinite number of universes in which the single cell organisms actually evolved. So it's not a fluke. So you can't say that evolution doesn't work. The problem is, of course, that this isn't science. Okay, by definition, with science, you have to be able to predict something will happen, and then you need to be able to test that something's going to happen. That is what science means. Now, the scientists usually beat the theists or the God believers over the head saying, well, you can't actually predict what God's going to do, and you can't test God. And so therefore, what you're believing isn't science, it's rubbish. But what I would say is, this ain't science, right? It's not testable. How could you know that there are an infinite number of universes out there? We can't. No one can. And even if this is true, how can you predict in any one universe that organisms are going to pop into existence and pop out of existence? Now, I won't go into all the theory behind it. It's all got to do with quantum mechanics, which is an extraordinarily strange theory of its own. But just to let you know, one of the things with quantum mechanics is that, in fact, you not need even just single-cell organisms. You might actually need conscious brains to pop into existence and out of existence for universes to work. Okay, and that sort of means that God might exist, and they don't like that. So the way they get around that is there's this idea of Boltzmann brains, which I won't spend any more time on, but it's the idea of the fully conscious brains popping in out of existence so that we won't go into all that, but it's rubbish. I mean, well, it's not rubbish, but I mean, essentially, it's faith. I mean, you can't test it. It's no more testable than God in a lot of ways. In fact, it's less. So one of the things is that they really don't exist in, you know, people point to all the animals that have ever existed and all of the animals that have been sort of fossilised, and they sort of point out there's no missing links. And you know, here's Noah saying, no, we don't want any missing links, you know. And so they sort of go off saying, oh, well, let's go and hide in the fossil record then. So that's sort of God getting back at the missing links. So we go to the next one. So the main part of my talk then is not really about trying to refute evolution anymore, because as I said, the evolutionists are very slippery and they want to bring their version of God into it, and you can't really talk against that. What I really wanted to do then was talk about something I am sort of more interested in, which is where is the mind? And you should all be interested as well, because you've all got a brain and a mind. So as a neuroradiologist, I'm very au fait with what the brain looks like, and when a part of the brain dies, you can actually often see a symptom attached to that. And so over the course of many centuries of watching bits of brain die and also stimulating bits of brain with electrodes, the scientists have actually worked out what all the bits of the brain pretty much seem to do. So it turns out that the vast majority of it, right, is actually associated with either accepting sensations from the body and then interpreting or, you know, modifying and integrating those perceptions, so visions back here and sensations here, and proprioception, which is like joint positioning, is here, and sound is here, and, you know, and that takes up a lot of space. And the other bits are all to do with organizing movement, coordinating movements. There's a motor strip, which basically, if you sort of like touch this little bit, you know, leg will flick or your fingers will flick. And so when they actually try that, well, where does the one mind actually sit? It ends up being this little bit. Now you sort of think, well,
Yeah, okay. I mean, it's not a lot, is it? Like, it's a bit, you know, maybe it's a fifth, maybe it's a sixth, maybe it's not that much. I mean, you know, creative thought and writing and intellect and judgment. I mean, why is that bit about the same size as the bit that looks at organising visual stimuli? It doesn't sort of make sense. So to my mind, the brain really looks like an interconnector or a body adapter. It's sort of like just sort of taking what the body actually what actually presents to it and sort of like modifies it. And that doesn't really work. Go to the next slide. And so as a neuroradiologist, and you know, I've seen a lot of cases like this. It actually comes from a journal article. If you're really interested, you can look it up just to make sure I didn't make it up. But there are a lot of diseases in which the brain can be much smaller than what you think it should be. So all this black stuff is water. Okay, this patient actually has a form of disease called hydrocephalus, which literally means water in the brain. And obviously you can see where the name came from, because all this black stuff is water. And the bit of brain that's actually still there and functioning is this little strip out here, which is around about a centimetre and a half thick. And you sort of think, oh, okay, this guy has got probably only 10% of his brain left, so he must be a complete cretin. Well, it turned out he was married with two kids, a civil servant. Now, you might think, well, maybe civil servants don't need to know much. They did some testing. Now, his IQ was 75. Now, to give you an idea, normal average IQ is about 100, so he wasn't the sharpest tool on the shed, but he wasn't a complete moron either. So then it sort of come down to the mind, well, where's the mind in this guy? Because, I mean, you know, there's not really much left. Go to the next one. So I sort of come up with this idea, well, okay, I mean, most of the time they say that, you know, science is 100% knowledge and God is 100% faith, you know. Can you actually test God? Can you actually do a scientific experiment with God? So I thought, well, maybe you can. So, talking about the brain and the mind, so science, right, is based on the idea that all there is matter and energy and forces and nothing else. You're not allowed to have anything else, right? So everything that exists, everything that happens, anything that you can measure is just matter and energy. And what they would say is the brain is nothing more than a computer. And the neurons which make up the brain are the hardware, and the mind that you think that you have, so your mind is basically that bit that sort of like thinks and plans and loves and all that sort of stuff. And it's nothing more than software in the computer, and it's basically all of your thoughts are just electrical signals. So in that instance, the mind must be part of the body, because we know that there's nothing else but matter and energy. So of course the mind must be partly matter and partly energy. That's all there is. But God says something completely different. And he uses a different language, which you sort of have to get around. But he says, well, look, okay, what he tends to suggest in the Bible, if you've read it, and I suggest you do read it at some stage, is that you have a body and you have a soul and a spirit. The three usually sit together, but they can be completely separated. Okay? So in Hebrews 4:12, the word of God is active and alive, sharper than any double-edged sword. It penetrates even to dividing soul. Now, it's a different buzzword, but essentially the soul, when you look up what it does in the Bible, it tends to suggest that it's probably the mind, what we would call the mind, but the soul and the spirit. Now, what's the spirit? Well, science doesn't have a clue about the spirit, and even the spirit's quite difficult, but it seems to be the heart. So, your desires, and it's, you know, we won't go into the spirit because it's even harder. Joints and marrow, which represent the body. So what God's saying is the mind is actually can be completely separate from the body. So they might cohabit in the same space, but they're not the same. So this is actually a difference. Science says it must be part of the body, and God says it ain't part of the body, and we could give that a test. Go to the next one. Now this is where it becomes sciencey, and I don't want to exclude everybody, so I thought, well, how am I going to explain? Because obviously science is saying that the brain and the mind are part of the machine. How am I going to explain that? And so what I thought was, well, you guys, much more than me, because these things didn't exist when I was your age, understand this stuff, right? iPhones, and if you're into, I mean, I'm not into Android, but so I'm using iPhones. If you don't like that, it's bad luck. But the good thing about it is that there have been, since the first iPhone in 2007, all these iterations, okay? So the iPhone has evolved.
right? And so this is sort of like mathematical stuff, which most of you wanted to get rid of. But so on the bottom line of all these graphs, I've just plotted each different iPhone year after year. Now, the good thing about iPhones is that Apple want you to sell you new iPhones, so they brought in a new one every year. So we can actually see what they've done every year. Now, the first one looks at function, okay? So what does the iPhone do? Now, you could look at that from a number of different perspectives. But everyone knows that this year's iPhone is a little bit better than last year's, is a little bit better than last year's, is a little bit better than last year's, but hey, until there's like five or six of them, I'm not going to update my phone because it ain't that much better. So what I actually end up plotting here is the number of pixels in the main camera. Starting in the first iPhone, iPhone 1, all the way through to iPhone 13, which has only just come out this year. And you can see that it's sort of like a bit of a step-stair thing. If you put a line along it, which is the line of best fit, it's a linear progression. So, you know, what does linear progression mean? Well, most of you would understand a linear progression. If you go into McDonald's and you want to buy a meal for yourself, you might fork out 15 or 20 bucks. If you want to buy a meal for three people, it's going to cost you three times that much. All right? That's a linear progression. As you buy something, it costs incrementally more. So the function, and almost all the functions in iPhones are the same. It doesn't matter what you pick. I just picked pixels, but you know, number of number of songs you can play, or number of screens you could have open. It doesn't really matter. It's roughly linear. Now, what is behind all of that? Well, one of the things is the memory. Now, one of the things that Apple like to do is they like to make it more expensive to buy a phone with a bigger memory. They almost always offer three different memory sizes. One that's too small to actually be useful to anybody, but it's cheap, and that's the headline rate. One in the middle, which is like Goldilocks, and there's one at the top end, which, you know, if you're really a big end user, you really crave, and so you buy that one, and you probably waste your money. But, so this is our 14 or whatever it is iPhones, and this is actually the amount of memory that they have, right? Now, this ain't a straight line. Now, it turns out, I didn't make this big because I didn't want to frighten you all, but it actually turns out it's a logarithmic function. Now, what does that mean? It means that, essentially, it takes off faster than linear. That's all you've got to know. Okay. Zach, could you explain that to people that don't really know? This sort of comes into the idea of diminishing returns. Now, girls, if you turn up to a perfumery and you buy perfume and you look at all the perfume and you say, well, okay, there's one there that's worth 10 bucks and on the next shelf there's one worth 100 bucks. Now, is the 100 buck one 10 times better? No. It might be 10% better. All right, that's diminishing returns. It costs you a hell of a lot more to get a slight improvement. Now, this is saying is, you get a slight improvement, but you actually need to have a lot more memory to do that. Okay, that's how computers work. And I'll show you that this isn't just a fluke. I didn't make this up, it's not rubbish. It's actually real computer science. You actually know some real computer science now. Diminishing returns. Now, the next thing is the amount of software. So that's the hardware. What about the software? Well, this is iOS size. So iOS is Apple's internet software. Essentially, it's their software for the iPhone. The first iPhone used this little blue box. The most recent iteration is this blue box. It's a very, very, very nice curve. It's not quite, for the mathematical aficionados, it's not quite an exponential curve. It actually ends up being a parabola. So it actually increases as a square, but it's still diminishing returns. So I'll go to the next one. So, as I said, if this is real science, it should be able to make a prediction and you should be able to test that. So I went back and I said, okay, if you're an Apple fanboy, then you believe that the iPhone is state-of-the-art mobile computer in your pocket. So what would happen if you went back 38 years before iPhones even existed? What would this state-of-the-art mobile computer look like? So one of the things I thought was, okay, well, I can use this curve to predict what the working memory of a state-of-the-art mobile computer 38 years before the iPhone existed would be, simply by putting a number 38 steps backwards, which ends up being minus 37. It turns out there's no iPhone zero. So if you put minus 37 into this equation you can't see, then you follow this line all the way back here somewhere, and that'll tell you roughly how big the iPhone's working memory should have been, which is
33 kilobytes, which is 0.0033 megabytes. Now, Apple don't even sell them in megabytes anymore. They sell them in gigabytes. So that's another three zeros. So 0.0000033. Right? That's tiny. So why did I pick iPhone minus 38? Because I did know in 1969 that they sent this rocket ship, which is a Saturn V, to the moon. And they needed a computer, the state-of-the-art mobile computer, to do it. And so they developed the Apple Guidance Computer, which had exactly 4 kilobytes of RAM as its memory. It weighed about 30 kilos, and it's about 1,000 times slower than... So essentially, it's no better than a pocket calculator. But if you look at these numbers, that was the prediction. That's actually what was back then. So I was only out by about 18%. That's not a bad... I mean, to go back 38 years is ridiculous. You don't usually extrapolate that far. But that's actually pretty good. So, we made a prediction, we tested it, it sort of really worked. That's what it looked like. Imagine that in your pocket. Yeah. Go to the next one. To show you that this isn't garbage and this is actually real computer science, is this idea of Moore's Law, which is a computing science law. So I've talked about the software and I've talked about the memory. In the middle of a computer, there's also a thing called the central processing unit, or the CPU. It does all the calculations. I mean, it's a bit boring to people that don't want to know. But this guy called Moore realized that the transistors, the number of transistors in a central processing unit, which is basically what does all of the number crunching, doubles roughly every 2 years. Now, the first computers came out in about 1960s. So they've plotted 1970 all the way up to 2020, and they've got this straight line. So all these little blue dots are all of the CPUs that have actually been from the first one, which was Intel 4004. You know, Intel ones mostly, but so it looks like a straight line. So, well, that's not an exponential graph, but yeah, this is actually a logarithmic scale. So this is actually going up faster than linear. So they've done that to make it pretty. But if you'd actually made this a linear scale, it would have gone, whoa. And it'd actually be very hard to show. So what it means is that all these scaling laws I'm trying to show you, they actually really exist. So, okay, next one. So here we have a fish talking to his mate, evolving rather quickly, don't you? Yeah, I only put this in because he got a mobile phone on. It's pretty good, eh? Next one. So then, okay, so I spent all that time, why did I spend all that time telling you about computer science? Because you're not really interested, really. Well, obviously it's difficult to do it in absolute terms, but you can actually work it out. You can work it out in relative terms. So, okay, dogs are pretty smart, chimps are pretty smart. How much smarter is a chimp than a dog? And you say, well, how can you work that out? Well, believe it or not, there are actually dog and chimpanzee psychologists, and it's their job to work out how smart they are. That's a job for you, if you don't have a job. So how would you work it out? Well, you do a NAPLAN test. If you want to work out how smart a sixth grader is, you give them a NAPLAN test. Well, you do the same thing for dogs. It's all about reading, writing, and arithmetic. So it turns out that a dog can understand around about 165 words. And as far as arithmetic's concerned, dogs can count 1 plus 1 equals 2. Now, they also know that 1 plus 1 doesn't equal 3, and 1 plus 1 doesn't equal 1, but that's about as best as they get. They don't do division, subtraction, multiplication, anything else. And they don't go any higher numbers. If you gave them 1 plus 2 equals 3, they're completely bamboozled.
What about cats, Greg?
No, it wasn't doing cats. Oh, okay. Well, the problem with cats is they don't want to actually work with psychologists. Whereas dogs are very, I mean, as I said, dogs have got Williams syndrome, so they want to do what the psychologist wants them to do. Okay, so then we get our chimpanzee. So it turns out you can actually teach chimpanzees American Sign Language. In fact, this lady is a chimpanzee psychologist. She has taught this chimpanzee, whose name was Washo. Turns out he was a pretty good signer. He got up to 350 words before he died, and he could have conversations using a vocabulary of 350 words. It's also chimpanzees can add up single-digit numbers up to about 6. So if you give them 3 plus 3 equals 6, they'll get that right. If you make the numbers much bigger, so 4 plus 3 equals 7, they start to underestimate, they start to get it wrong. They're not that great, but they're better than dogs. So what this all suggests is that chimpanzees are probably about twice as smart as dogs. They have twice the vocabulary, and they're able to use probably at least twice the amount of mathematics that a dog can. Okay, next one. So how does twice the function scale with the hardware? Because I told you before, in computers, if brain is nothing but a computer, that it should be an exponential function. So it turns out, so what is the hardware anyway? Well, you all know that it's a neuron, and that's a little schematic of what a neuron is, and what it basically is, it's a cell that takes information from other neurons through these things called dendrites, and then it makes a decision as to whether it's going to fire a signal down its other end, and that's this axon, and that can be really long, that can be up to like a meter long. And at the other end, there's these little axon terminals which talk to other dendrites. So it's like a switch. It either fires or it doesn't fire. Okay, so that's the idea, is that is the computer hardware. So it turns out that dogs have around about 429 million neurons, and chimpanzees have about 2.8 times 10 to the 10 neurons. And you say, well, how do you do that? Well, people, that's their job. They count neurons in dogs. That's another job for you. So what this means is that dogs, like chimpanzees, have twice the brain function, but they've actually got 65 times the neurons. So obviously that sort of makes sense, really, if you're thinking that all of the brain function, all of the mind of a dog and a chimpanzee is hardwired in, that's roughly right. I mean, that's roughly a logarithmic function. So intelligence seems to be hardwired into dogs and chimps. Fair enough. What about humans? Go to the next one. So this is the big crux of the matter. We know that evolutionists like to say that we're nothing but upgraded chimps. So how much smarter is an average human than a chimp? Well, I've already given you all these figures, so you know those already. So the average human carries around about 35,000 words. Now, obviously, someone like me might know a few more, someone else might know a few less, but the average is 35,000. Now, 35,000 as opposed to 350, is 100-fold more. So that's getting up there, right? And then what about calculations? Well, chimps could add numbers up to 6, but after that they sort of got, and they couldn't do anything else other than addition. There's this thing I found called the Mental Calculation World Cup for people that are really into that sort of thing. And so the first part of that is you have to add up 10-digit numbers. So you get this sum with like 100 digits in your brain and work it out. And then the person that gets the gold medal is the one that can work out, like, correctly the most of those in a certain period of time. But then they've got other things, like they'll give you, you've got to work out which day of the week a certain calendar date is in 60 seconds. They'll ask you to multiply 2 8-digit numbers together and get it correct. Or work out the square root of a 6-digit number, and it has to be accurate to 5 decimal places. So we're not talking about what's the square root of 36. We're talking about what's the square root of a number with 6 digits, and it gives you lots of reminders. So by any stretch of the imagination, humans would have to be, at the very bare minimum, at least 100 times smarter than chimps. Now, I actually think we're probably smarter than that, but I sort of thought, well, okay, look, if you divide that by that, it's 100, so it's an easy number to work out. So we'll go to the next one. So, how does 100 times the function scale with the hardware? It's the same thing we did with dogs and chimps. How many neurons do we have? 8.6 times 10 to the 10. How many neurons do chimpanzees have? 2.8 times 10 to the 10. It just turns out humans' brains have around about 3 times the number of neurons. Now, is that anywhere near enough in a logarithmic function to get 100 times more function? Well, it doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? Because this number is actually smaller than that number, so that's not going to really work. And in fact, it turns out, I mean, I played around with it, it's actually really difficult to predict. If you were going to have the intelligence of humans hardwired in compared to a chimpanzee, our brains would have to be at least 3,000 times bigger, maybe 10,000 times bigger. Now, the average human brain, it turns out, is about 1.5 kilos. So you need to have a whale, a blue whale-sized brain. Which ends up being not functional, like not practical. So we'll go to the next one. So essentially what that means is then is that God is starting to come up trumps here, because he said, well, in fact, your mind doesn't fit in your brain, it just is associated with it. And then just say, okay, well, that's the hardware. Yeah, the hardware doesn't work. Okay, we're accepting that. But maybe it's the software. Maybe it's got to do with how everything, the information. Surely there's more than enough information. Well, all of you started as a single cell, a single fertilized cell. Now, I'm going to go into how that works because hopefully they've taught you how to at school, biology class. But all the information that actually takes that one cell to trillions of cells of 400 or 500 different types, making a huge organism that might, 70 kilos, that can eat and reproduce and heal itself, all that information actually has to start in there. And that's DNA. And you might have all heard about DNA, it's one of those things. And what it looks like, it's said to be a helix, which means it's twisted. And there's rungs, and each of those little rungs can be one of four different types. And it turns out that the rungs, the order of the rungs is actually what carries the information. So it turns out, how many rungs are there in a human? 3 billion. How many rungs are there in a chimpanzee? 3 billion. Exactly the same number. So the software, at first glance, is exactly the same. So we get 100 times the brain function for no increase in cellular software at all. So that suggests there's nowhere for the brain. Go to the next one. One of the next things that evolutionists like to point out, which is true, is that, well, okay, maybe it's not really so much the size. Now you're scratching at straws, because I mean, obviously I said, well, you really should be a square function. But maybe it's really the difference in, but there are some differences between apes and humans, and maybe it's the difference. So it turns out those 3 billion rungs on that ladder, which is twisted, which we call DNA, would fill around about 1,000 textbooks, right? So obviously he's trying to impress her with his knowledge. He's got his textbooks there. There's 1,000 of them. Turns out that's one CD-ROM. Now, most of you probably barely remember what a CD-ROM is, okay? So CD-ROM is what you used to buy information. If you want to upgrade your computer, it came as a CD. If you want to buy music, it comes as a CD, you know. Actually, CDs were like a long, long way after I was buying music on vinyl platters. Sounds sad, I know. So, in fact, the entire genome fits on one CD. It's 750 megabytes, which isn't much. It's about a quarter of the information required to run your iPhone currently. So the amount of information to run your cell and create a billion cell organism which can reproduce and walk and talk and think and worry about its existence is actually much smaller than an iPhone. Well, can't figure who could do that, who could possibly fit all that information into such a small space. We won't get into that. So it turns out bonobos, which is another type of ape, the DNA in bonobos is around about 98.7% identical to our genome. Now the evolutionists will bash you over the head and say, well, that means that you're nothing but an upgraded bonobo. And it's really not that much difference in information. But what I would say is, well, yeah, you know, it's a 1.3% difference. It's 750 meg. It equates to about 13 volumes or about 9.75 megabytes. Really and truly, the difference between a bonobo and a man is really just a bug fix. So it cuts both ways, right? So the body of a bonobo and the body of a human are probably not that different, right? It's only a bug fix. So, I mean, yeah, obviously our legs are a bit longer and we're not quite as hairy and we probably look a little bit more acceptable to each other than if we were marrying a chimp. But in fact, there's nowhere, absolutely nowhere, for 100 or 150 times the intelligence to fit. It just won't go, right? And that's what you want to, when they start telling you, yeah, you're nothing but an upgraded chimp, you say, okay, but I'm 100 times smarter than a chimp, where does that fit in the 1.3%? And you say, well, you know, don't fit. Next one. So then it sort of comes down to, well, you know, that's all very well. Is there really any other evidence? Turns out there is, and it's actually really fascinating. So there's a guy who's a medical doctor. He's actually an oncologist, which is a doctor that deals with people dying of cancer mostly. He's a radiation oncologist. And he heard a lot of stories from some of his patients about them dying, having weird things happen to them, and then being resuscitated and coming back.
And so what he did was, he said, I want to study this because this is really interesting. And so he started an online portal for people who had these experiences, and they could actually write down what happened to them. And so he developed a questionnaire which they fill out, and then he decided to do science on it. So it's not just rubbish, he decided to do science on it. So these things are called near-death experiences, and they've been reported in about 17% of those people who basically nearly died. It's been reported by children and adults and scientists and physicians and priests and ministers and those who don't even believe in religion and atheists, and from countries all over the world. So it's not just Bible-believing, you know, Anglo-Saxon white people. And so often what happens is you get this thing called an out-of-body experience, which is the apparent separation of the consciousness. So the mind and the body separate. Oh, isn't that interesting? That sounds similar to what I've been talking about. It happens in about 45% of near-death experiences. And so essentially what happens is that they often hear and see things from a perspective that's apart from where they are. So they're often above themselves or they're behind themselves or something. And so what he did was he studied 287 of these things and he asked them about, okay, well, you died, and while you were there, you were watching what happened, and the doctors and nurses or whoever was there tried to resuscitate you, and obviously that was successful, otherwise you wouldn't be talking to me. What happened? And so they are actually accurately able to give a description of their entire resuscitation. Not only was it realistic, it lacked any content that seemed artificial or unreal, and it was accurate. And then, in order to do science, you needed to compare that with something. Well, he had that because he had people that had near-death experiences without out-of-body experience. And he asked them, well, okay, you were resuscitated, what happened? And they were no better than guessing. So the people that had an out-of-body experience were 97.6% accurate about what happened, and the people that didn't have an out-of-body experience were no better than guessing. Now, that doesn't take too many people for that to be statistically significant, which science would say then say is valid. So this is actually valid science. In fact, if you're interested, it actually was published in a valid scientific journal. So it's real science. So out-of-body experiences seem to actually work, even though other scientists would say it's all hogwash and, you know, rubbish. So he's got 3,000, at the time he wrote this, he had 3,700 near-death experiences. Actually, I went back to his website, it's up to over 4,000 now. And what he found was, when he looked at them, 74% of them had said that their consciousness was actually more impressive than what it normally is, and they were more alert than normal. But what actually happens when you die is your heart stops. And when your heart stops, there's no blood going to your brain. Now, your brain needs a lot of blood. In fact, if, you know, all you guys sitting there, about a fifth of all the blood your heart is producing is going to your brain, even though your brain ain't doing anything, perhaps. And the reason for that is it needs a lot of sugar and it needs a lot of oxygen to keep going. And so, essentially, it stops working. There is no electrical activity after about 30 or 40 seconds of the blood going to your brain stops. Now, it's not completely dead yet, it's just not functioning. So all these people are actually having these lucid, conscious understandings of what's happening to them when their brain ain't working. So that's a problem. Maybe there is a separation of the brain and mind. So it turns out near-death experiences associated with vision in people that are blind. And so, well, how could people that are blind tell you about vision? Well, it turns out that when he talked to people, some of them had floated off above where they were and they'd gone outside and they said, well, I could see that, you know, there were roofs of houses and some of them had these oblong things and there was smoke coming out of them. And he said, oh, they're chimneys. And he said, yeah, well, I've heard about them, but I never knew what they would look like, but I knew what they looked like. And they were actually explaining that this house had one and that house had one and that house had one and that one didn't. And when they went and looked, that was all accurate. So how could these people that were blind... And the people that do have vision, they often said, well, actually, what actually ended up happening is that the vision I had when I was dead was actually super normal. I could see extra colours, not just the normal seven. There were extra ones, infrared and all sorts of things. People have had near-death experiences under general anaesthesia. Now, if you're an anaesthetist, you need to give enough general anaesthesia so your brain don't work. So it shouldn't happen, unless your anaesthetist should be sued, but we won't go into that.
Often what happens is that these people have, say, sometimes they say they have life reviews. So they get to see part of all of their life, and the reviews might actually jog their memory to things that they've long forgotten or that they never knew, and they come back and they ask their relatives, did this happen to me when I was five? And they say, yeah, it did. But we didn't tell you because we didn't want to, you know, upset you. And they go, oh, I saw that in my life review. So how do they know that? And this is all science. This guy didn't make it up, apparently. But the real scientists would say, well, maybe he did. But that's a long stretch. So, well, why would someone want to make all this stuff up? And then one of the other things is that people that have these sort of experiences sometimes encounter people that they had known previously that have been long dead, like long dead relatives. Now, it turns out that when you have dreams or hallucinations, the vast majority of times, if you see people that you know, it's almost always someone that's or it is currently alive or in recent memory, not someone from long ago. But in fact, these near-death experiences are almost always people from a long time ago. Now, I don't know if it was a near-death experience, but I do remember that Steve once said that he saw his father once, yeah, who had died. Yeah. And that was like a bit spooky, but yeah, he would at least agree with me that maybe it really happens. So here we have Homer having an out-of-body experience. So we've got the next one. And we're almost towards the end. I mean, it's good that you're not asleep yet. I'm happy that all the eyes are open. It turns out that if you look at the Bible, now the Bible sort of prefigures this long before anyone even thought that this existed as a real thing, okay? Paul talks about it, but he's very, very, very confused about it. So in 2 Corinthians 12, 2-4, as I say, if you want to check me out, you can read it. He talks about it in the third person, which I suspect he does because he's so confused and he's so embarrassed and he doesn't know. He's sort of like, you know, well, it happened to a guy. But it was really me. And we'll talk about why that might be him. But I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven, which is basically what God is. That's the third heaven. Whether it was in the body or out of the body, I don't know. God knows. And I know that this man, whether in the body or apart from the body, obviously that's a real sticking point for him. I don't know. But God knows. He was caught up to paradise and heard inexpressible things, and things that no one is permitted to tell. Well, how would he know that they're inexpressible and you can't tell them if it wasn't him? Because if he heard it from somebody else, obviously he couldn't tell him and couldn't express them anyway. So he had an out-of-body experience long before that was fashionable. So we'll go to the next one. So that's some great moments in evolution. So obviously, you know, you can't have... Evolution doesn't work by wanting something, okay? They want to get to their ball, but that doesn't work that way. Next one. So I'm sort of towards the end, which is just as well. Take-home messages. So, you know, humans sort of evolved dogs out of wolves by removing and not adding genes. All of those breeds were actually already in the wolf, and really that's not really how evolution's meant to work. It's meant to be just blind and not preemptive, so that doesn't work. And even things like, you know, a lot of... you know, you hear about antibiotic resistance. A lot of that is actually turning genes off, not actually new ones, but anyway. Science is also now recognising the limited evolution that we do see is often by removing genes and not building on them, which is problematic because it's not the way it's meant to work. Scientists would predict that the mind must be part of the body because that's all there is. The Bible predicts that the mind is actually separate from the body. When you try and work out whether or not a chimpanzee is an upgraded dog, there seems to be enough hardwired in neurons for that to be possible, but in humans it just don't fit, okay? So that doesn't work. And if something doesn't work in science, you can't go on accepting it. God did something different with us. Next thing. So, how does this affect your belief? So, if you believe in God, you're not a fluke. You're not a fluke of nature. You are made in the image of God. You are different to animals. Their brains are hardwired in, but you have a mind which is vastly bigger than your brain can possibly hold. You have worth. You have a future. If you want to believe that you're nothing but an upgraded... So this is Darwin as an upgraded chimpanzee. People actually, when he first brought out his theory, they lampooned it because most people believed in God and they thought it was laughable, and so they tended to do this sort of thing to him. So, you know, you're not, you know, I'm a fluke of nature.
I'm no better than an animal. Our upgraded pond scum. I have limited or no worth, and I am doomed. You can believe what you want to believe. I know what I believe.
So, I don't know how long I've talked to him for. How long did I go for?
Probably went over, didn't I?
We wanted to have a time for questions. Now, I don't say that I'm going to be able to answer them all, because unlike most scientists who would lie and try and gild the lily, I don't know all the answers either, but if anyone has anything they want to ask, is it worthwhile? Was it useful?
Yes, great. Yes.
Did you like it?
Yes.
You didn't go to sleep, so that's good.
So I can point.
Yes.
With the boat hook of knowledge.
Was it Jacob who ended up working for Laban, and he put different coloured sticks
in troughs to make the sheep speckled or striped?
Was that turning off a, or turning on a...
Well, I don't know. Because, I mean, that really, you know, that would be lost. There's another guy, Lamarckian. You shouldn't really be able to turn genes on and off by putting sticks in troughs. But, I mean, you know, God was obviously doing that. Now, God, this is the other thing about science, is science doesn't believe in miracles, because obviously miracles would have to happen outside of what we know as energy, and part of the reason why, you know, you can't invoke God in science. But God can do whatever he likes. I mean, you know, if he wants to make all the sheep speckled and spotted, if he wants to tell you to put stringy bark in troughs, whatever way floats your boat. I mean, if he wants, you know, if he wants someone to be healed, now he encourages you to pray for them, but he doesn't need you to pray for them. He just encourages you to pray for them. That's more about your learning, isn't it? You need to learn what God's like. Any other questions? I haven't really bamboozled you that much, have I? I thought there'd be lots of hard ones.
I have a question.
Yes?
Where do mutations fall into? Is a mutation like a lost part?
Yeah, so there are, I mean, you know, it turns out that there's, you know, so I gave you the simplified version. So there were 3 billion rungs on the DNA. In fact, it's sort of chopped up into 42 different chromosomes. And they're basically, there's copies in there. So I just run out of breath, but. So if you take a page of text and you put it through a photocopy, you get a copy. And the copy looks almost exactly the same as the original. But it will turn out that there'll be a couple of pixels in there that are wrong. They're just random errors. The copier made a mistake. If you take those copies and run them through, and then take that copy and run it through and do that a million times, what you'll be left with is something you can't read anymore, because there'll be more errors than there is original. So it turns out that although our DNA is amazingly good at reproducing itself, we actually give our offspring copying errors. So my three boys have on average 300 copy errors more than what I started with. And I have 300 more copy errors than my parents had. And they have 300. And if you sort of think about that, So, you know, evolution will tell you that, you know, there are billions and billions of years and that we separated from apes, you know, a couple of million years ago. If you think about, you know, we could probably reproduce every 15 years if it was put to a stretch, and if there was, you know, 15 billion years, a million years, there'd be at least a million copies. Now, how wonderful are the copies going to be after all that time? Well, as I said to you, evolution is all about the idea that you get beneficial copies, errors, they're hard to get, and that you get rid of all the bad ones. Because if you don't get rid of all the bad ones, you're actually going downhill. Now, what they don't tell you is that we know that you get around about 300 copy errors per generation. The best that they expect that evolution can do is to get rid of one copy error per generation. So unfortunately, we're actually all going backwards. It's called genetic entropy. Entropy is this idea that everything falls apart. So if you go into a child's room, it doesn't spontaneously clean itself. It gets dirtier. That's just entropy. Genetic entropy is the idea that, in fact, our genomes are getting worse. And now doctors understand this. If you look at a textbook of genetic problems, like genetic diseases, it's about that thick. Right. The number of genetic diseases we know about is enormous. Now, you all carry a genetic disorder without knowing it. You all need to eat vitamin C. If you don't eat vitamin C, you'll get a disease called scurvy. Now, if you went on a boat trip, on Captain Cook, no, not, yes, had vitamin C, but if you went on a boat trip for like 6 months, you didn't eat vitamin C, your skin would start falling off. Now, it turns out you actually all have a gene in your bodies that can make vitamin C, but it's defective. And you can get away with it because there's a lot of vitamin C in the environment and it didn't make any difference. But, you know, that's one of the genetic errors you carry. And you will all give that error to your children. The commonest genetic disorder is colorblindness. I'm colorblind. Anybody else colorblind? No? Anyone have a brother or colorblind or a father colorblind or... Anyway, so it turns out around about 6% of the population have colorblindness. I'm just one of them. That's a lot. Now, you know, if color vision evolved because it was so much more useful, then why hasn't evolution been able to get rid of colorblindness? Because obviously that's bad vision, bad color vision. And they won't answer that. They'll say, oh, well, maybe bad color vision is also beneficial. It probably is for radiologists because we actually probably have slightly better vision for looking at shades of grey, but that's not it. It turned out that they used to use colourblind people in the Second World War to try and pick camouflage troops because they were better at shades of grey. Because they, you know, if you believe that's true, I mean, I actually would rather have my colour vision back than be able to, but anyway, that's by the by. So in answer to your question, yes, it's copying errors. Copying errors. There are all sorts of different types. There might be just one letter out of those 3 billion, or it might be a whole chunk has been shifted, or a whole chunk has been turned off, or it just doesn't work for other reasons. But, you know, thalassemia and, you know, you could go through thousands and thousands and thousands of genetic diseases. All of them began after the fall, and there are probably new ones occurring that, you know, all the time. Because you're all going to give your children three more copy errors, 300 more copy errors than you had. Go figure. Yes?
This is like just a half thought.
A half thought?
Yeah.
So you only needed like half the number of neurons for that? So chimpanzee could have thought. Anyway.
It's like the
R,
right?
Yes.
What, do you think that God put in like species? Or family, and on that, because you were talking about the peppered moth, right?
Yep.
And you said that, was there a reason for saying that you don't believe in natural selection? Or you do to the point of like...
Well, it might work up to a certain point. So, essentially, for natural selection to really work, you need to have lots and lots and lots of generations. And you need to be actually finding new and novel and worthwhile genetic errors faster than you're actually collecting bad ones.
But does that mean that on the arc, like, would he put in, do you think he put in two snakes? Or like two of every species of snakes? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Short answer is I don't know. But that doesn't mean I can't speculate. People have thought about this and they've said, well, obviously, if all of the dogs in the world started off as a grey wolf, then maybe all of the dog-like creatures, so all of the wolves and all that sort of stuff, might have started as one thing, and that thing just had lots and lots of different genes that got turned off. So for instance, all of the polar bears have almost exactly the same genetics as the brown bears. They're essentially the same species. It's that the only difference is polar bears have about a dozen or so genes that have been turned off. One of them makes them white. One of them actually makes it so that they can actually eat a diet high in fat and they don't die of atheromatous disease, which is bizarre. So one of the thoughts is that, you know, you didn't really need to have, like, and there's like 10 million different beetles in the world. Maybe there were just, you know, groups. That's one of the thoughts. The other thing is, obviously, not everything needs to be full grown on the ark. You could have put in, and some of them could have hibernated. People talk about the idea that, I mean, some things wouldn't need to be on the ark. I mean, you know, they could sort of like hitch a ride on some floating trees or something. But, I mean, I come back to the idea that I believe in God.
Now, if God really created the entire universe and everything that's in it, and a chimpanzee is about twice as smart as a dog, and I'm about 100 times smarter than a chimpanzee, how much smarter than me is God? Or maybe God might be a billion times smarter than me, and I've got no idea what he did. Maybe I'm just shooting up. And you actually get that. Now, I did say I read the whole Bible. There's a book of the Bible called the Book of Job. And Job, we won't go into the whole story because it's a bit nasty, but he ends up having a bad time. And right at the end, he's really cheesed off with God. And he says to God, he says out loud, you know, well, God, I want to get you down here and I want to bitch and whinge and I want to know why you did this to me and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so God turns up. And Job's there. And what usually happens when someone like a human sees God is they fall down dead. And this is what happens. He'd be completely speechless and was completely frightened and scared out of his wits and didn't know what to say. And God said, well, yes, you've got all these questions, but I actually don't have to answer them. And even if I did, you couldn't understand them. He says, you know, where were you when I created the entire universe, when I made this, when I made that? Where were you? And of course, Job goes, oh, you know, I'm nothing. I'm like an ant. I mean, I don't know. He goes, well, I'm God. That's the answer. I don't know. Sorry. But it's interesting to speculate.
Okay.
Yes?
What are your thoughts on Neanderthals?
Neanderthals?
Yeah.
A lot of that, I mean, I'm not a paleontologist, so I mean, I'm sort of speaking out of turn. But my understanding is a lot of that stuff is all based on, so you might think that they've got an entire skeleton, right? A lot of those sort of like primitive humans are a single bone, or a bit of skull, or a little bit of teeth. And then they sort of extrapolate that. I mean, I went back 38 years for the iPhone minus 38. That would be like going back, you know, 2,000 years on the basis of a tooth saying this is what, you know, an ancient human looked like. So a lot of it is extrapolation and, you know, you need to then work out, well, is that really likely? Some of that, I mean, so there's a lot of humans that are born that are so deformed now that if they were fossilized, you would say that they were a completely different species, you know. Unfortunately, a lot of the dwarfs, you know, achondroplasia is a disease. I was talking about genetic diseases. That's a disease that affects cartilage. And all bone is built out of, most bones are built out of cartilage models. And so that's why they're short. And it's very unfortunate. It all comes down to, there's lots and lots and lots of these things in the Bible, and then people then say, well, do you really believe that the world is only 6,000 years old? Well, I mean, God says that. Jesus actually believes it. Jesus was there, you know, if you believe that he's God. So a lot of people want to say, oh, yeah, but God, you know, it's not really 6,000 years, it's really longer. And they say, well, Jesus believed it and he was there, and so what? Who am I to sort of say it wasn't? But then I sort of think, well, okay, say the world really was 4.5 billion years old and that our species had been evolving over, say, 2 or 3 million generations, and there's entropy. How much of a workable genome would we have left if we were giving our offspring each time 300 copy errors? How much of it would be legible? Not very much.
Yeah.
So it turns out, if we were only 6,000 years old, how many copying errors would there be? Well, there might be a few thousand that are any great note. And what would they look like? Well, they'd look like genetic diseases. Well, how many genetic diseases are there? 3,000 or 4,000? So I don't know. Maybe it's true. I'll leave you with it. You can think about it. Anything else?
So where would you say, you said a little bit ago something about like how the soul's like the mind?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at what the Bible says about the soul, and it's, you've got to remember that the Bible isn't really a science textbook. It tends to describe things in words that ancient people could understand because they were writing it. So they could hardly sort of say, I want you to write that the mind is actually a computer system that runs software. That didn't really work. If you look at all the attributes that the Bible talks about the soul, it tends to be things that we would equate with the mind. So one of the passages I didn't put up there, it talks about, you know, don't worry about, you know, people on earth that can kill your body, or going, you know, you should worry about going to hell where your soul can be destroyed. But it turns out your spirit can never be destroyed, because even if you go to hell, your spirit goes back to God. because that's his part of you that he takes back. So it seems to me that, and most people, commentators I read, that most of what the soul seems to be, we would equate to our mind.
Because it says like mind, soul, spirit, right?
Yep.
So like, wouldn't they be separate?
Well, they are, but they all cohabit the same thing. So they often sit together. So in a computer, you can have hardware and you can have software. Now, they might actually be together and the computer's working, or the hardware's over here and the software's over there on a disk and they're not working. But, you know, you can still put them together. One of the interesting things about us is that we, you know, God says you've got a body and you've got a soul, which I think is the mind, and you've got a spirit. And we're made in his image. So what does God look like? Well, he's a mind, God the Father, he's a body, God the Son, and he's a spirit, God the Holy Ghost. So it looks like we've got three things, because he got three things. And a lot of times his three things can be together. Okay, now you've got to remember, when Jesus actually goes into the river, to the Jordan, to get baptized by John the Baptist, you actually see all three parts of God being separate. Because Jesus goes into the water, comes up, heaven opens, God the Father speaks, so he's up there and Jesus is down there, and he sends a dove, which is the Spirit. So there's all three bits, and they're completely separate. But then the dove alights on him and they're back together again. So there you go. As I said, I mean, it's very profound. If you actually want to look at the Bible, at what it says about all this sort of stuff, and think about it deeply, it's actually much more profound than any human could have come up with back then. You know, tens of thousands of years ago. I mean, and the Bible is written by 40 authors, and there's like 66 books or something. And it doesn't actually, I mean, if you had 40 authors trying to put together a book for you, and they all wrote one or two, maybe up to 14 chapters, I mean, would it make sense? Well, you can't get two directors on a film and it makes sense. So, I mean, that seems to me that God could do that too. Anything else anyone wants to know? David. Of course, anything you ask that I don't like, I can chastise you about later.
So where do things like societal and like, so for example, like, are there genetic defects that we can physically discover that suggest that someone's going to be homosexual?
No.
So that it's not. Are there any hardwired genetics in animals that suggest that they will be homosexual, or are we the only species?
Well, no, there are other animals that can be homosexual. I think dolphins can be homosexual. Now, that comes down to the idea of, I think that all of this is very difficult, and it's quite a difficult topic for us to discuss, because in some ways it would sound disrespectful. I don't want to disrespect anybody. And so, essentially, in some ways, even the scientists didn't want there to be a genetic defect. There is no genetic defect for a start. Okay, no one's ever been able to find one. Even the scientists didn't want there to be one, because, of course, how would you inherit a genetic defect which makes you predispositioned to not want to reproduce? That don't make sense. That actually would make evolution a bit of a joke. Okay, now, you know, I don't know what percentage of the population are homosexual, but that wouldn't make sense. Now, it's rather interesting. So there are genetic disorders which do play around with the way that sex works. So it is known that if you, how can I put this? When you start as a single cell, you could be either male or female. Okay, all the information for a complete male and a female is in there, actually, because there's an X chromosome. You might have two X chromosomes and you've only got the information for a female, or you might have an X and a Y, right? Now, the Y chromosome, it turns out, is only small. It's tiny. It's only a switch. What it does is it turns off all the female bits. So during embryology, if you study embryology, which I had to do because it was part of my course, all the way along, to a certain point, an embryo looks both male and female. They have both components. There's both Wolfian duct components, which make the male bits, and there's Müllerian duct components which make the female bits. what actually ends up happening is if you have a Y chromosome, it turns off all the Mendelian duck stuff, and you then become male. And if there's two X's, it turns off the Wolfian duck stuff and you become female. Now that can be a problem in that you can actually have people that are mosaics and they have some cells that have got an X and a Y and some that have got an X's. And then you can get hermaphrodites. They can have both male and female bits. And then you just say, well, how does that, well, you know, how does that work with the brain? Now it turns out that although the brains of males and females in the human species are almost identical, when you actually go looking really closely, there are differences in the amount of cells, neurons given over to different things. I mean, women are better at some stuff, men are better at some stuff, and it sort of makes sense. And that needs to be induced. Now, that's induced by a whole string of different hormones and different triggers. Now, what would happen if some of those triggers were genetically defective? Well, theoretically, it would be possible for someone to be born male but actually feel that they were female. That's not out of the question, because it just meant that the triggers that was actually going to mature their mind and their brain towards being that gender were wrong. So I don't necessarily see that as a problem, and I don't necessarily see that as a disease. I mean, it's probably going to end up being just an error. Much of what you take as being you know, we don't know what we look like after the fall. I mean, Adam and Eve were quite surprised at how they had changed, and they didn't probably change much. But if you compared yourself to Adam and Eve, you would say, wow, I've got so many errors and problems. I mean, you know, as I said, I mean, I'm colorblind. Some of you have got probably, I don't know, all sorts of weird genetic problems. But as far as like sort of sex and gender and stuff, I mean, it's not really my area, but I don't necessarily see it as, as necessarily being all sinful or bad. It's entirely possible that it's actually to do with genetics. But as far as straight out homosexuality, no one's ever been able to find a gene, and they didn't expect there to be one, and if there was one, that would have been very embarrassing to them. Okay, anything else? So there you go. What time is it? 10 to 7. Okay, hand over to Alex.
Let's all thank Dad or Grant. I think it's a topic that's ever increasingly more important as we see the lack of talk about that in schools and how there are actually two sides to the argument, and I think it's important to understand both, particularly if you're interested in that, and work out what you believe for yourself and then go from there. But I also wanted to point it back to, I guess the importance of that and sort of like thinking about evolution and science and faith and how all that works, but then also realising that actually what God wants from us is just us in a relationship with us, and although those things are important, they're not the most important thing. But it's also very important to discuss and talk about, so thank you very much for that, Dad. That was very good. I might pray and then we'll conclude the night for tonight. If you want to stick around, some of us may have dinner and hang out here for a bit. If not, that's completely fine. Thank you again for coming tonight, and I hope you enjoyed the talk. Let's pray. So dear Lord, I just want to thank you so much for the opportunity to, I guess, discuss and learn about all these different aspects of science and faith. And thank you that it's not a fact of just having complete and utter blind faith in something that we don't understand, but actually aspects that we actually can understand and can actually test and can actually see your handiwork in that, God. And I thank you that, the incredible aspects of life and science that we see is actually your mind at work, actually something that you planned and actually a purpose that you put in place. And the same goes for us as individuals as well, that you have plans and purposes and reasons for not only creating us, but creating us all different, and how we all bring different skills and abilities to life, but also different, I guess, aspects of you, which I think is really awesome and really incredible to see. And I just want to thank you so much for that, God. And I just really pray that, if people had things that were brought up or stirred tonight, they'll continue to look into that and actually ask the tough questions, want to learn more about what life actually means, God. And I just really pray that your Holy Spirit would bring them yeah, closer to you, help them to be open and honest, and even asking you that, and actually wanting to find that directly from you as well as others, God. But I just really pray that you would bless everyone tonight. Thank you that they're here, and I just want to thank you, yeah, ultimately for your love for us and just how incredible you are, God, and thank you that yeah, you love each and every one of us so incredibly, yeah, incredibly amazingly, and we actually do have a purpose. We aren't just here by fluke or by chance, and ultimately as a holistic perspective have no meaning, but actually you provide that meaning, God, and we love you so much, and we thank you so much for that, and thank you that you loved us first, God. Amen.
Amen.
So thank you again for coming. Hope you have a yeah, great rest of the night and rest of the week, and hopefully see you next week.
That's great.
Two.